potential when the eyes are half open, half closed. Interesting. The limbic brain emits its full potential when the eyes are half open, half closed. Now every mystic knows this, that the only way he can really draw on God within his being, the only way he can vibrate his energy out is the half open, half closed eyes. And he can block thousands of people glaring at him simply by looking at them with one darshan. Knock out all the wind out of them. And he has smitten all my enemies upon the cheekbone, and thou hast broken the teeth of the ungodly. In other words, that force field goes right through them and they're blocked. Their love is so great that comes through the half open eyes. But there's nothing else for the man in anger or in hate to do but look at you, well, we're going to do it. Then they will begin to realize salvation belongeth unto the Lord. Thy blessing is upon thy people. The man who gives darshan to a screaming host of people automatically radiates so much love that what happens to that 10,000 people, that they are like spiritualized. They're immobilized with the love. They can't help feeling the love flowing for them now. They can have all types of questions to ask you and to harass you, but you just give them one darshan, they calm right down, and before you know it, they don't know what's happening to them. They feel like they're losing their vitality is going out of them. That's the power of the spirit. And again, it says, Silla, so be it. Well, I think I had many encounters like that when I was in Virginia Beach. And every time, like, so the situation is simply that the security of God's protection is based upon that particular love. It's good.
When we meditate, we really don't
no is big enough. What is what occur in us? And when anything occurs in us, we are a little afraid, sometimes skeptical or worried. Now, since we are skeptical or worried, we begin to doubt. The fear that we are not doing the right thing. And if we're afraid that we're not doing the right thing, we start calling up the person who taught us meditation and asking, well, what do I do now? What do I do now? What do I do now? How do I know I'm getting results? Is that the way challenge feel? A buzzing song in my ears, or the roots of my hair being dragged up, big pain in my head, a cold sweat and trembling all over the place? And if you say yes, that's the way you should feel. But I didn't feel that when I was in the other church groups. I had very nice feelings in those church groups, and now I join your group here, I'm getting all kinds of sensations. Something is wrong. You tell them nothing is wrong. This is the normal process and how the mechanism works. And they're partially doubtful and partially calm. If they keep up the meditation, eventually they'll calm down. But sometimes they're afraid to continue, so they avoid. So David is showing how we should respond in this condition. Inside, if you're half restless or half calm. Hear me when I call. Let me feel inside that the contact I made of this inner peace, this attunement, is flowing through. O God of my righteousness, that means the right principles of meditation or thinking. Love. Thou hast enlarged me when I was in distress. My consciousness expanded beyond the limitation of the negative pull when I began to meditate. When I began to meditate, I was in a certain state of negative thought patterns because I was frustrated, and now I'm meditating. I've gone beyond the frustration. My consciousness is stretching. So my consciousness has expanded. Therefore, have mercy upon me and hear my prayer. In other words, let this consciousness flow through me so that I am competent to handle it, and I know without doubt that everything is working as it should. This is confirmation that the symptoms that are occurring in us in meditation are real, and they are nothing to be afraid of. They're just going on naturally inside. O ye sons of men, this is the usual conflict now coming up between you and the higher consciousness in meditation. How long will ye turn my glory into shame? How long will ye love vanity and seek after leasing? Leasing. Consciousness is saying to the person in meditation is this: how long will you go along doubting the possibilities of the experience being genuine? And what you think is happening to you is partial and not the real thing. You don't really have a full comprehension or full confirmation of it. There's no real certitude. Now, so you will doubt and dabble and try to avoid going to the fullest acceptance that these symptoms are real, these symptoms are genuine, and that this is a real spiritual life. This is what must occur in the body to bring out the spirit. So you'll continue in the leasing. That means you will try to accept partially, get involved partially, and then try to withdraw to compare. Now, when you lease something, you really don't own it. So, if you don't really have a full conviction that these symptoms that are occurring in you in meditation are truly the right symptoms that's supposed to happen, you're going to be doubting, and you're going to going back to the old feelings that is the right symptoms to have. And then you say, well, every time I get into meditation, I have these peculiar sensations. Now the Lord is getting sort of angry here, because he's showing in his own words, the way he's saying it back to the brain or the consciousness, that we are kind of foolish. O ye sons of men, O you egos, that's another way of saying it. Higher consciousness is saying, okay, ego, wait a minute, take it easy. How long will you turn my glory into shame? How long will you avoid facing the intuitive nature? How long would you avoid this particular inner certitude, this inner wisdom, this inner luminosity of yourself? How long will you love vanity? How long will you remain in the unrealistic thought patterns? They are not real. They're like show. The sensation of the sensory nature are not real. They're not the real experiences. They're not the real sensations. The real sensations is this pulling of the head, this twanging in the ears, this gnawing sensation of being expanded and stretched and flowing. These are the real things. These are the real extrasensory frequencies that you've got to get into. How long are you going to keep avoiding them? How long are you going to try to disassociate from them? And seek after leasing. Seek after other conditions that are only temporary and not permanent. Whereas these symptoms are
permanent
once you understand them.
That's why I say
all the symptoms of cosmic consciousness are God awareness, are identical
like sickness.
And therefore, they feel alike, they look alike, but there's a difference between sickness and cosmic consciousness.
And sickness,
it's permanently
there,
creating a
disturbance in the cells.
In cosmic consciousness, you
have an experience of it,
knowing that you are master of it. It doesn't
affect you.
You transcend it.
But no.
In other words, realize the Lord, the creative intelligence, has set apart him that is
godly for himself.
Now that individual
who is going to have cosmic consciousness
is set aside
to experience all these symptoms that are similar to sickness.
You know, when a man's sick, you don't want to be near him,
right?
When you come close to a cosmic conscious person, he's just the same. You don't want to be too close and
near him.
He might infect you with his love. The Lord will
hear
when I call unto him. The Lord will hear
when I call upon him.
So, once the person is
following the path of inner consciousness,
he will hear this
awareness.
He will be drawn to this awareness.
And he will recognize
this awareness. But he will be set aside from every other individual because he is different. He's not the same individual no more. He's taken a different attitude to life. So he's going to be
criticized,
he's going to be ostracized, and therefore no one would really relate to him. So the higher consciousness is saying again, stand in awe. Remain firm in your own consciousness where you are. And stop dibbling and dabbling with your wandering mind. Begin to be where you are and shape up. Quit this so-called
you love me, love me not.
Technique of the mind.
Get down to the actual realization
that you are singled out for realization.
And because you're singled out for realization,
you will
be realized.
In spite of yourself. In spite of others trying to tear you down,
you've got to be realized
because there's no other way for you to go.
So stand in awe.
Stand in this retrospect, in this condition. Accept yourself
and be it.
And
sin no more.
That is, don't deviate from the
ideals that you set up to pursue the spiritual life. You have been singled out
to pursue a life of discipline, of love, a life of self-conscious,
ethical life.
So because you're singled out, you may think, well, people think you're kind of weird. they don't want to trust you. You look kind of stupid or something, sitting down and munching on wheat bread and brown rice, or some carrot sticks. They think you're weird looking, or something's wrong with you. And they'll try to encourage you to go and have hamburgers and cokes, and all types of variations, because you're standing for, you have chosen to do this particular mind expansion by a rational method. They think you're touched in the head. But your science of the religion, your science is telling you how to face these people. It says, stand in awe, accept this relationship, and don't deviate, don't sin no more, don't
break away from it.
Stick to the path. This is the discipline.
Commune with your heart,
practice your meditation upon your bed.
Go find a spot
in your house and forget these people who are going to constantly
pull you all over the city
for their virtue. Get in your bed and sit down and do your Simran or your hallowing the holy name.
And meditate with your heart.
Start bringing your consciousness up to the eye center.
And quit
getting involved in their
negative pull
to tear you down.
So the science
of the soul is specific.
It gives you a
legitimate way to offset their pressure.
Commune with your own heart upon your bed and be still.
The process is actually you sit
down on the bed
and you calm
the mind for the first time.
Really, not trying to tell the Lord how to run his universe. One time I did that, you know what he said to me? You think you can change it? Try. And that was the end of my
busy trying to figure out what he was doing in this world.
I realized I can't change anything because there's nothing there to change. What I have to learn is how to accept him as he is. And that's the miracle of the whole process. Accept him as he is. Whatever happens to you, happens to you. He has a reason for it to happen to you. And he has a reason for relieving you from it. So there is no
argument anymore.
Strictly live as he is. As beingness, and you are free.
There's no more
conflicts.
You see?
So, right away, I surrender to the idea,
the divine will.
And beingness is divine will. Now, stand in awe
and sin no more,
as we say. Stay where you are and don't go be pulled. Others with their thought patterns,
trying to tear you down,
trying to repeat the old habit patterns again that you're trying to avoid.
Don't generate
those desires that tend to deteriorate you. And commune, that is, sit down and meditate with your own heart,
with free will,
free joy, happiness. Don't do it like a sort of mechanical thing, you know. Meditation is not the, it's a joyful thing. In other words, sing if you want to sing in meditation, relax,
be still in your own bed,
find a spot. You use the word bed because that's very close to you, and there's a lot more closer to me than a bed.
That's a place where you sleep at night,
and you really trust the Lord then. Because when you're sung to sleep, you don't even know if your person is taking your shoes off.
You really
trust the Lord then when you're sung to sleep on a bed.
So using a bed is your
sacred spot. It's a personal spot.
And be still.
Be just as still as if you were sung to sleep. Don't fight the issue.
Or don't try to
generate thought patterns. Then that wonderful Hebrew word comes back,
Selah.
What will be, so be it.
You can't fight this.
He's telling
you already
that this is the way of the initiate.
The initiate
accepts
and live it out.
He gets involved in his environment, but he doesn't run from his environment.
The involvement
is the action, and the action
is the freedom.
Then he says, offer this sacrifice of righteousness. It's the kind of sacrifice he wants.
Yes, I
offer sacrifice in terms of material things.
When you sit down to meditate,
offer the sacrifice of
righteousness.
That means
you send up the thought,
Father, I love you. That's the biggest sacrifice
you can ever make
with your mouth, with your mind,
with your heart.
To tell an unseen God that you don't even know what he looks like to love him. That's a challenge. It's easy to love somebody and tell them you love them because you can see them. You see me, you tell me you love me. That's because you remember what I look like. Have you ever seen God to tell him you love him and already feel it?
That's difficult.
But that's a sacrifice. That's why it's a sacrifice. Because you got to make that particular attempt without knowing what to trust in to make it click for you, to turn you on from inside and put your trust in the Lord. Put your trust in a feeling that's going to come up your spine like you speak up the top of your skull and down back. You got to trust now. There's vital life power coming up in you. It's called Kundalini or vital power, and it tingles right all the way. You got to trust that now. You don't even see what it looks like,
but you're feeling it.
And you got to trust that.
Pretty rough deal.
But the scriptures are telling you what you got to do and what you have to accept. And there just ain't no other way you can do it. The science of the soul is very specific. And in the Psalms, which is called Mantra Yoga, it's show you how you have to relate to this thing and make it work for yourself. I'll flip the side off. Thank you. Now we've covered the two types of people that exist. We covered the relationship of the government and the system that we exist in the first two Psalms. And the third Psalm, we see now the head of the government is caught up and has to find inner communion to offset the patterns of harassment, what we call modern-day lobbyism. So we're moving on now to man's happiness is in God's favor. How the inner consciousness gains contentment by total awareness. That's God's favor. Inner contentment from the ego nature to total awareness. There be many that say, who will show us any good? We've all been that rod. Where we have said, is there anybody here who love us or do something for us? Or do anything good for us? Lots of us have done this.
I've said it many times.
It's only natural.
And why should it not be natural?
It is because
we don't
know how to evaluate. The mind is not trained to evaluate spiritually yet. It's only evaluating
in terms of need.
It's not evaluating in terms of compassion and mercy and grace. But only in terms of need and security. So we say there be many that say, who will show us any good? Lord, that's your last resort if you don't commit suicide. You always turn to this unseen force. As if he's out there waiting for you to ask him. Sometimes he's not even waiting for you to ask anything. Simply because
you can't live without relating
to a higher part of your
being
as a supporting force
within you.
Unconsciously, subconsciously,
intuitively,
you sense this and you can't relate to it. And you don't want to accept it. You want to feel that you're free enough to do without it. And you fight
desperately.
Come on. Tapes and they're all finished because they're all good and snoozy. That'll be the joy of Thanksgiving. We're coming back now to man's happiness is in God's favor. As I said before, we covered the first two Psalms. First one tells you the types of people you're dealing with in the world. You have to pick a side and be one or the other. The right thinker, or positive one, or the wrong thinker, or the negative one. In the Bible language, it's called godly or ungodly. And then the second psalm deals with your environment, political makeup, kingdom, and all these forms of existence in which we find ourselves. The third psalm shows you your protection in the reference of the environment, in that particular frame of activity. How comes the fourth psalm?
There,
the very head of government seeks to be aware of how it will guide itself. And at the same time, it's telling you as a person, in your own internal guidance, how you guide yourself. But when you guide yourself, there must be a result. You don't just guide yourself out to something by nothing. It must have some value. By your fruits,
you will know
if you're making progress.
A tree is known by its fruit.
The man of spirituality is known by the fruit of his consciousness and his inner peace.
So man's
happiness is in God's favor. There be many that say, who will show us any good?
This is true.
Many of us will question anybody doing good for us.
Lord, lift thou up the light of thy countenance upon me.
In other words, let this consciousness radiate. Thou hast put gladness
in my heart
more than in the time that their corn and their wine
increased.
Joy
comes
from within,
not without.
One can have a bumper crop, a large payroll, and still be discontent. But the joy you feel in meditation every day is
entirely different.
It spreads out through your entire being, and it starts in the heart center, the heart chakra. And there you hear the bells ringing inside, the very first inner experience of the sound current. When the heart chakra opens up, you hear the bell ring. You listen to the sound current, and you're drawn back to God for the first time, and you're attuned to it. And it lifts you up. And I will both lay down, me in peace,
and sleep.
You know this
word sleep
repeated itself again.
How many psalms?
Every time we read a psalm, there's a reference to sleep. I said the technique of this mystic life is to be able to think a thought and forget it, just like you do in sleep.
If you can do that,
you will have the power to work this consciousness, the ability to shut it off. Now, if it keeps holding on, then it's wandering. Therefore, you have no control. The idea is to have a thought and let go. Then consciousness flows. For thou, Lord, only makest me to dwell in safety. In other words, by our natural makeup of consciousness, we would protect ourselves. And if we accept our environment, wherever we are, that we are in the right place, at the right time, for the right experience, this is eternal safety. Even if a house is falling down, and you are there at that time, at that particular place, when it's falling down, with that consciousness, you are still going to be safe. Because it will pull you out. And that's what we call making it by the skin of your nose or photo finish existence. You're locking it through. This is divine will. It works. A hairy, scary, nerve-wracking existence. But it is divine law. And you just got to accept it and enjoy it. And if you ever get on a spiritual path and you're really looking for something hair-raising, follow divine will, you can find out. There's nothing more here raising and more, they call it, nerve-wracking. And real, they call it, have all the thrills like a roller coaster up and down. And that's divine will at work. Now, God favors not the wicked. It's telling you exactly where the favor is, where the particular function of truth exists. God is love, and love don't nourish wickedness or ignorance. Love doesn't sustain it. It withdraws itself. It's like the species that came here at one time in existence. Some of them have gone because they served no purpose after a while. They couldn't sustain themselves. Their multiplication would be too great. They'd have to eventually destroy themselves. If the dinosaurs were around, what would happen? Many of the huge mastodons that were here, if they kept on multiplying, what would happen? We find that nature has a way in which she arranges all these forces to keep the balance. It's our mystical way, our marvelous way of maintaining harmony. Now, if we say survival of the fittest, then that's a kind of wrong statement when you apply that to a dinosaur. Who could have survived? Who was more fit to survive? You get the idea? Because he was stronger, bigger, and healthier. He was far more fit to survive than the smaller creatures.
But then if you look at the scriptures give you a clue who actually survives. The meek will inherit the earth. Who is really surviving? The strong or the weak? Or the meek? Which one of the three really surviving? It's not the strong surviving. It's not the weak surviving. It's the meek. A meek person is not strong nor weak. A meek person is humble. He's attuned. Therefore, he's synchronized to life itself. He is living divine will. He survives. He that doeth the will of the Lord is my brother and my sister. That individual is surviving all the time. He's right. He's accepting divine law. So, we come to that particular statement that God favors not the wicked, which is the psalm, it's a psalm. And therefore, when thoughts are coming up into our consciousness, we realize that unrighteous thoughts or negative thoughts really don't have any virtue. They're going to fall apart. Tests that we made in the labs between cultures of generating love with your right hand and generating hate with your left hand. And after a while, the cultures died under the left hand. And those under the right hand began to multiply more. And cultures that had no thought given to them, simply neutral, partially multiplied, died out. So even love is important without animosity. See, you have the animosity to a neutral thing. Say, well, I don't love it, I don't hate it, I'm hands off. Even that dies out. And those that with animosity dies out. And those that you have some intimacy or bond, it survives and thrives. Now this is proven. Let's relate this to cells, flesh, the human body, which is the temple of the existing principle, and work it now. See how it can work. If we can work it, then we've got something within our control. That's what we're looking for. How we can consciously control this mechanism to apply ourselves constructively in our environment efficiently. Because that's what we're here for. We're not here to run from the world, we're here to live in it. But only by living it can we understand it. And understanding is the highest thing you should get if you're going to get anything out of spirituality. You can't carry riches in your grave, so that's out of the question. Health is something that if you understand these principles, you'll have it. Debt is a condition. If you understand it, you surpass it. Debt is your last enemy. That is your last opposition. So what is really the purpose of existence? The art of how to live. If you know this, then you understand your existence. Then there is no more dilemma in your mind. There is no more limitations. You are a free person. Because that's what you're supposed to be. Free. In charge of this mechanism. Now, the psalm says, give ear to my words. Listen. Don't just mere hear. There's a big difference between hearing and listening. Give ear to my words, O Lord. And consider my meditation. Now we come across this strange word, meditation, long before the Maharishi came around to visit us. This word meditation is haunting us now. How do we meditate? Find yourself a bed and commune with your heart. Simple, right? We don't have to go and find fantastic techniques. We know how to do the thing. That is just surrender, let the thing happen. Give ear to my words, O Lord. Consider my meditation. That is, when you sit down to attune, your words should be the Lord's name, you hallow it, or Father, I love you. Merely Father, I love you is potent enough to open the centers in your being. Hearken unto the voice of my cry. Well, which father is going to deny when his child says he's loving? Which father or mother is going to be hard-hearted and shut out this
feeling when the offspring says, I love you. You see how powerful the weapon you got? God can take back everything he created in this world from us, even life. But the only thing he can't force us to give up is love, because he's love himself. He's inside of us. We have to give it to him freely. That he cannot employ no pressure upon us in any way to love him. Now, the moment we say we love him and let it really happen, he brings this into manifestation. He is forced to reciprocate to you. Hearken unto the voice of my cry, my King and my God. That means now you're making consciousness the focal point that governs you, which is King, God, a supreme ideal principle within you. For unto thee will I pray. Unto this particular relationship, I will bind myself. That's why I say meditate day and night. We bind ourselves to this commitment of an ideal and an involvement, a sense of judgment and a sense of action. My voice shalt thou hear in the morning. Now he's telling you again the time. I says that this morning, the best time for meditation is what time? You get up at 5 o'clock and do your 2.5 hours meditation, right? My voice shalt thou hear in the morning, O Lord. In the morning will I direct my prayer unto thee and will look up. Now when you meditate, what position should the eyes be? Turned up to the third eye, the center between, the Christ center in man. It should always be attuned at the third eye, or truly. Thereby, we are validating now what the Japanese scientists are saying. When the eyes are half open, we have the full potential of the brain at work. Jesus is saying, when thine eyes are single, the whole body is full of light. Well, all these only tell us one thing. Look up means the same thing. There are only three positions that the eyes can go into. Forward, down, or up. Time for yoga classes, right? The person who had my keys was Hap Merck. And I, consciousness should be lined up at the eye center, the pituitary, or focal point, the mental microphone of the brain, because you're broadcasting. But you're not broadcasting anything else than, Father, I love you. You're not asking him for anything. So real meditation is strictly a flow of love. Loving the Lord thy God with all your mind and heart and soul and your neighbor as yourself. There's no greater force than this particular type of communion. There's no greater mantra than, Father, I love you. It's the cheapest mantra I know. It don't cost you no $75 to learn. And it don't cost you any fantastic fee to be attached with. Simply that you've got to do it. And doing is the whole essence of it. For thou art not a God that hath pleasure in wickedness. For thou art a consciousness total that doesn't engross itself with deterioration. That's what wickedness only means. Self-erosion. Neither shalt evil dwell with thee. That is, negative living. Total consciousness does not sustain or entertain negative living, sooner because it will perish. It will fall apart. The foolish shall not stand in thy sight. Now, the first time we run across the word fool and foolish, Jesus says, call no man a fool. There must be a reason why we never use the word fool to a human being. Because there must be some law we are breaking that we're not aware of, some thought pattern we're setting up that we're not aware of, and we involve a karmic debt to it. Now, clung is a different thing. You can clung around. You can say the man is a clung. When you say man is a fool, you're actually cutting the very vital life principle that's in the individual representing the creator and addressing the creator as a fool. And therefore you are addressing yourself at the same time, because you and the individual are drawing the same breath from the same atmosphere at the same time. That's why Jesus is making a very specific meaning or issue of not calling another individual fool. The foolish shall not stand in thy sight. Thou hatest all workers of iniquity. The consciousness cannot stand the fact of destruction by its own volition. Though it has the desire to destroy itself at times, but even then it cannot stand the fact, because it's committed by its own natural law to repeat the principle all over to test itself. It will have to go through the process of learning again. Have to come back to another body form to learn out the mistake of making that mistake of killing itself. So it has to learn that lesson. Thou shalt destroy them that speak leasing. Now, destroy don't mean literally hit them on the head and kill them. Those individuals who are constantly living in the mind wandering, like a leasing, one house put the next out, leave one house put the next out, constantly mind wandering, they are gradually going to find themselves running out of desires and ideas to latch on to. They're going to be totally empty after a while. They're going to reach what is known now, total frustration. The Lord will abhor the bloody and the deceitful men. We know we can't survive by hurting others continuously. And we know we can't constantly trick our neighbor or abuse him constantly, because we will be doing it to ourselves in actuality. In the end, we are doing it to ourselves, not doing it to anybody. So the real lesson we are learning is, when we look at ourselves, we find out that to be happy must come from inside. Thank you.
J.J. O'Connor. as we said earlier, God favors not the wicked. That's the negative thinkers. And we're dealing with Psalm 5. The verse we read is verse 5. The foolish shall not stand in thy sight. Thou hatest all workers of iniquity. And I mentioned, this is the first time we encounter the word fool. And the Master Jesus admonished man that he should never call his fellow man fool. There is a cosmic principle behind that. When you call another person fool, you're actually calling the God principle in that person too. And that is implying your own self, because the two are related. You and the God principle, or that person and the God principle, are related. You both draw breath from the same source. And when you tear down another individual in that aspect, you create the karma. Thou shalt destroy them that speak leasing. In other words, we are defeated by the mind wandering. Leasing is something that you come and go. You're never permanent. You're never stable. And when the mind is wandering, it has a tendency to deteriorate and tear you down. The Lord will abhor the bloody and deceitful man. Well, Jesus points that out. If you live by the sword, you die by the sword. If you hurt someone and you destroy someone by deceit or plot his death or his particular destruction by premeditating it, his kinfolk will want vengeance. It's only natural. So they will go out and try to destroy you. And if your kinfolk want vengeance, you go out and destroy their kinfolk. And we have what is called a feud, like the McCoys and the Hatfields. And all over the world is like that. We have this feud going on. But David is saying, as an initiate, but for me, I will come into thy house in the multitude of thy mercy. That is, the initiate will turn inward at the eye center. The human body is the house. You're initiated into the cosmic life stream, and only when you turn inward, you enter. Now, at this point of the mechanism, the brain, it's the only part that can really generate mercy. You have to see and think. And once you think, then you can be merciful. Can't do it if you don't have a head. If you're living in your senses, you couldn't do it. You have to live on a higher plane of experience, a higher plane of awareness, to be merciful. But as for me, that is the initiate, I will come into thy house, the human body, in the multitude of thy mercy, that's the storehouse of mercy, consciousness. And in thy fear, and meaning in that particular respect, attitude of respect, not a fear from damnation or a fear of destruction or a fear of being torn down, but it's an attitude of respect. You haven't designed your body. You don't know how it functions truly. And when you turn inward, you have to have some respect for its construction. And it's that construction that you must turn to and glorify and worship toward thy holy temple. So David is saying, but as for me, I will come into thy house in the multitude of thy mercy, and in thy fear will I worship toward thy holy temple. That is to say, the initiate will turn towards his human body, which is the temple, one between the eyebrow, located in the volume of mercy, which is the head, And in that respect of fear, he will commune towards the holy temple, the light, that he sees it in the body. Lead me, O Lord. Well, we know there's a chant that says, that song with light, how it goes, takes me back home. No. You want to sing it? So the initiate is saying, lead me, O Lord. That is, may this light guide you in thy righteousness because of mine enemies. Make thy way straight before my face. How is this possible from translation? To make your way straight by your face. It's kind of an odd statement. But when you're an initiate, you can understand what he's talking about. The light is within you and guides you. It's the Lord in meditation. And your enemies are your five senses that pull you out in the outer realm, in the sensory nature. And if you're going to make your face straight, you got to be sort of a poker face. Have your eyes turned in.
Just feel the cards.
So you see, when you look at the Buddha, his face is so serene, straight, turned inwards. And this is primarily the real meaning of looking inwards and making your face straight in the face of your enemies, your five senses. For there is no faithfulness in their mouth. Oh, look at your mouth. This is a peculiar phenomenon. We say things, and Jesus said, not what you eat, but what comes out of you. You have to come out of your mouth. So anything we say by our mouth, and if we don't follow up or maintain it, it's faithfulness. So he says there are no faithfulness in it, in their mouth. What comes out is faithfulness if it stays and can stand the test. If it can't stand the test, then it's not faithfulness. Their inward part is very wickedness. Their throat is an open sepulcher. So what is he talking about? He's talking of your whole mechanism. You can't trust it. You see, because it's going to put you in a state of conflict with yourself. Not what you eat will defile you, but what comes out of you will defile you. Your thought patterns, having an exit now through the mechanism of the body, are going to condemn you or put you in a position where you are not able to defend yourself. They flutter with their tongue. So normally, sensory desires that tend to stimulate or beguile you will detract your consciousness, and you'll try to pat yourself on your shoulder. And then you find out you'll have to eat your own words back. This is one of the peculiar phenomena of the spiritual life. You say something, you ain't going to do it, and then turn around and find yourself doing it. Destroy them, O God, meaning remove this from my consciousness. Let them fall by their own counsels. In other words, let me not be deceived by my aggressive, violent thought patterns. How they tend to tear me down. How my own cravings tend to destroy my mechanism. Let me not be a victim of internal body language. Cast them out in the multitude of their transgressions. In other words, let me get instant karma right away. Let me face up to my particular feelings, my particular commitments. For they have rebelled against me. That is, these thought patterns are set up against the need for growth and not to be trusted. So you don't want these thought patterns to tear you down. You don't want to build a consciousness on want. You want to build a consciousness on need. Now, scripture says every need will be fulfilled, but not your wants. So if your needs are going to be fulfilled, then your very tongue, which always states, I want this, I want this, when it doesn't happen, you rebel and you get very angry, only to find out that the very thought you are stating in consciousness, the very desire, is an incorrect desire. But a need will always be there, and that need could be fulfilled, not the want. But let all those that put their trust in thee rejoice. That means the need. Once you come to the realization of the need, let them ever shout for joy, because thou defendest them. If the individual put his trust in the needs and not the wants, the cravings of the thought patterns expressed by the tongue, let them also shout for joy because thou defendest them. Your need is always fulfilled. Your need is always made manifest in your life. And sometimes you express idle needs or idle desires years ahead of the time and they materialize. So you will see now that why thoughts are very peculiar. They have a time in which they come to completion. Let them also that love thy name be joyful in thee. That means the very tongue which loves to hallow the Lord by repetition now, which is a mantra program process, let that be joyful. You find joy by repeating the mantra. And the tongue is that particular vehicle whereby you repeat this process and the mind starts to experience joy. For thou, Lord, wilt bless the righteous. The creative intelligence will start releasing bliss through the mechanism for the first time as you meditate. That means following the right pattern of thinking. With favor, thou wilt compass him as with a shield. Now, you know how that sensation feels around your head when you meditate? Like if something is protecting you, like a maddening band, you feel like a force field around you. So when your consciousness is raised and you're on the eye center, you start meditating, you start to feel this vast force field around your body building up like a shield. This is the bliss, this is the consciousness that you're striving for in meditation. Now, the sixth psalm is David's complaint in his sickness. So we have a psalm now, or a mantra dealing with illness, first for guidance. Now we're coming across a complaint in his sickness. We're finding out that thought patterns are important in the health process. Here is David's approach. O Lord, rebuke me not in thine anger, neither chasten me in thy hot displeasure. That is, consciousness does not generate any type of vengeance, and the initiate feels that he must be attuned to this divine idea. Neither does he want to be hurt by the divine law of karma, that means chastened, in thy hot displeasure. Now, hot is temperature. The first indication of illness is a heat, a fever. The life energy comes up to the body in a vibrant heat, and the person is thrown into a state of frenzy or fear, or inner action. So the health harmony is to our balance, the polarity is to our balance. The consciousness now tries to stabilize my thought patterns because it does not understand why this particular imbalance is occurring. So the consciousness turns and replies, states to the life energy, have mercy upon me, O Lord. In other words, what is this that is occurring in my system? For I am weak. That is out of polarity. O Lord, heal me. Creative intelligence or life force is the only thing that heals. So it's the life force that must come forward in consciousness in the human being. For my bones are vexed. That's a peculiar statement, that your bones are vexed. Initiate must know what he's talking about. Vexed. When a person is vexed, what is he really saying?
Angry.
All right. Can your bones be angry? No? Well, your bones be angry. When a person is vexed with you, they would not cooperate with you, right? They tend to resist you, right? Isn't that true? So your bones really can't be vexed. They can lack the ability to cooperate in ambulation to your body. When you have a fever, you feel that all the bones are tightening up in your body. That is because the tremendous stress is going through you from the built-up toxins in the system. Oh Lord, heal me, or life force, heal me, for my bones are cramping up, contracting, resisting motion. They don't seem to have the energy to move. My soul is also sore vexed. That's an unusual statement. My soul is also sore vexed. Man is soul. He doesn't have a soul. That means my whole being is sore. When you start to get a fever, what happens? Don't you feel all your whole body sore? Your whole being is sore and resists any motion from the life force. There is no life force or pep in you. So David is saying, my soul is also sore vexed. That is, my whole body is in a state of resistance. Oh, but thou, O Lord, how long? The initiate is caught up in Kal, the time cycle. He's asking God, how long you got to be in this situation? You know, we have reached a point today, how long means how soon can I get a tranquilizer or some type of antibiotic to remove the situation? And when you take it, how long is it going to take to heal? The human body is always looking for some short way out to get rid of a particular situation, when in reality, that body would do a whole lot better if it go through a natural process of cleansing and come out a healthier body than trying to tackle the situation in time and worry about time.
No, I do it for me.
David is already despondent because the fever or the illness in him is starting to take its toll in terms of time. He's saying, return, O Lord, deliver my soul. O save me for thy mercy's sake. You see, when life is threatened, when the health is threatened, after we have abused it in some way, first major cry is for forgiveness. We want to repent. We feel despondent, we feel lost. It's a human trait. You don't know where to turn to. The sense of insecurity comes in. Your health is failing, and you fear. It's only normal to fear. But if your faith, like an iron will now, like an iron rod, will only hold on to the divine principle in you, you will be delivered. And we see that David goes through the same turmoil. He's saying, for in death there is no remembrance of thee. He's worried now that he's going to die, you see. And who is going to remember? Anybody remembers anything when they die? Right. So he had to have been an initiate of understanding the principle of death. And only in the body is it worth living to experience God realization. It's not worth it when you don't have a body, because you don't know how to live it out, because there's nothing to live it with. You need that body for the personal experience all the time. So the pain in the body is a necessary expedient for realization. Right. You must have the necessary trial to raise this consciousness, to be involved with the Spirit, and to experience the Spirit. In the grave, who shall give thee thanks? You see, he's very specific now as an initiate. He understands truly how can the dead man praise God. All right, the dead man is an electrical body, and he's in the idea body. But he doesn't have a chemical body. While he's alive, the chemical body is breaking down by illness or some type of internal conflict. But nevertheless, the initiate knows that if he would break through this particular situation and correct it, again he can continue the spiritual life in the chemical body. Discomfort, but it's a necessary means in which you get the strength. It is a discomfort to grow and feel sore and queasy all over and vexed and mean stiff, lacking the ability to cope with the situation of a body that you know and love and then want to quit it. So it, and then he goes on and said, all the night I make my bed to slip. That means at night to swim, you know. He's groaning, and all the night make I my bed to swim. Now you see, we didn't have no water beds over these guys. They done made their bed out of water a long time. I want my couch. Oh, the water is couch now. What does it mean? Huh? The water bed. You got to be pulling it up somewhere along the... I water my couch with my tears. In other words, the anguish, the agony, the perspiration, the groaning, and everything has come to the point that an old bed is swamped away.
Carried on through the night also.
Right.
Sleep and everything.
Good. Now, he says now, mine eye is consumed because of grief. In illness, the eyes get hot and red from the insecurity of fear that life may be going out of you, and the possibility of recovering is not in sight. No one is qualified to say to you, as an initiate, you're going to be well. Your trust in the divine presence is simply a matter between you and him. Right. Now, even if a master says you say you're going to be well, you take his word, you still got to wait till this wellness comes true. All right? Good. Mine eye is consumed because of grief. It waxeth old because of all mine enemies. That means the same eye that you use to pursue the sensory nature, which is your enemies now, is starting to get dim. Those pleasures don't seem to attract you now because health is leaving the body.
This is a different eye than the single health.
Right. That is because the eye of understanding or perception is starting to get a different sense of value now. You look around, you start to see people going around. You feel very, very, what do you call it, complacent, very lonesome. They're telling you good wishes, but your eyes have begun to see now the mistakes you made by using it. You were engrossed in the bullfight, or you were engrossed in drinking or playing, and you could have used your eyes for something better, but you didn't. Now when the eyes are burning up and the consciousness is ready to leave and the vitality is going, you start to cry out, I can't see, I don't know where I am. So these organs tend to bring on this grief. So he's saying, depart from me, all ye workers of iniquity. That means, depart from me all the desires. These are workers that tend to break down this mechanism. For the Lord hath heard the voice of my weeping. Intuitive nature is coming to the rescue now. I may transcend the pull of the senses. The Lord hath heard my supplication. The Lord will receive my prayer. The vital consciousness, the vital force is starting to spark. As he is repeating or calling upon it, he feels a glow. He feels an inner assurance he's gone naked. The will to live is there now. The only thing the doctor says when we're dying is that the man or the woman has lost the will to live. Now, if the Lord is the will, the vital power, and life is that force, and that will to live or vital force is pushed or pulled from within the mechanism to the surface, the human being will transcend his disease. The will to live, the will to survive. So that really means the Lord has heard my supplication, the Lord will receive my prayer. The will to live will come into manifestation. Now he says, let all mine enemies be ashamed, and all my sensory pleasures fall apart. In other words, your sensory desires and your friends who wish to see you sick and dying are all of a sudden they're waking up to see you getting well, healthy. You know, some people are very good well wishers in this way. Oh, he's got this disease, and boy, we sure wish he didn't have it. And every time they keep thinking he's got the disease and they wish he didn't have it. And they keep repeating the name of the disease and they wish he didn't have it. So they have a dualistic thought. One, he's got it, and one, he ain't got it. You see? So how can you rely on those individuals? Their thought patterns are hitting you and pulling you. Hitting you and pulling you. They can see into your aura and say, you've got such and such a disease. You're going to die. But they're not going to make no attempt to pray for you to get you well. So before you know it, when you do survive all their good well wishes, and this, you survive all their auric observations of you, they are puzzled. How did you make it? Look what connection you got to the Lord. See? They want you to die with their good wishes because they already see you dying from a certain disease, and now you're getting over the disease. You're a mystery to them. Get the idea? Let all mine enemies be ashamed. Let the thought patterns of those individuals who tend to crystallize the disease around you without ever trying to understand the cause and modify it, be ashamed. In other words, they're in a position to see by their auric vision or their extrasensory vision. They should not be the first to condone or admit the disease, they should be the first to modify the situation. If you have insight into a certain principle of another person's health pattern, you shouldn't be the first person to tell them that they got that problem. You should be the first person to try to wish that this force field would alleviate itself. So he says, let all my enemies be ashamed and sore and vexed. Let them all be confused. Let them return and be ashamed suddenly. In other words, let them come to the realization they were in a position to pray for the individual before the individual was informed that such and such a condition existed in him.
That's a good prayer. He's asking if they have the realization of their opportunity.
Right. So David is showing as an initiate how one should go through illness. The psalm now is that particular extrasensory aid or prayer form or affirmation to live out a basic problem. He goes on now to show you that once you have mastered this particular thought pattern of illness around you from others' thoughts, you're going to find yourself in their emotional feedback. So Psalm number 7 tells you he's praying against the malice now of his enemies. That's the emotional feedback. O Lord my God, in thee do I put my trust. That is to say, in the divine life current that heals and creates, it's the only thing we can trust. We don't see it. We have to accept its existence by looking at ourselves, that we are the result of this principle. We can personalize it by calling it God. We can call it Father, Mother, or whatever we want. But we have to trust it. So he says, O Lord my God, in thee do I put my trust. The individual must come to the actual realization that the divine life principle working through him and in the sperm to make him come in contact with the ovum brought this body into manifestation against the odds of other sperms in the uterine canal. He has to trust this divine law. Now, when you were traveling up the uterine canal as a sperm, the chances for you to succeed maybe a million to one. But the result is that you are here and the rest are not. And that is the actual test of your trust. You don't know how you got here, but you know you are here. And as long as you are here, nobody's going to push you out. So that is the trust, that is the divine will. Save me from all of them that persecute me and deliver me. In other words, once you accept this divine principle in yourself, the thought patterns of those who are constantly playing upon your consciousness, this same vital power now will pull you through, just as it did pull you through many other sperm to get to the ovum. And those other people around us in a living form now are only manifestations of the sperm. The same law applies now. How you succeeded to become a human being, you can succeed now to survive in your environment against the thought patterns of others. Lest he tear my soul like a lion, rending it into pieces, while there is none to deliver. Well, human beings have a tendency to tear us up, or like you say, that they're like wolves in sheep's clothing. They mean well, they think they mean well at times, but unconsciously they can be hurting us with their thought patterns, and they can tear us up. We have to be very circumspect, we have to be aware of that. We have to be attuned to the fact that negative thought can hurt us. We've started out the whole process with the first two types of people that exist, the right thinking type and the wrong thinking type. So we know that if we align ourselves with the spirit, we have to be right thinking, and we will have to have the opposite in confrontation. Life is polarity. Life is this contest. O Lord, my soul, if I have done this, if there be iniquity in my hands, now this is the first thing you were trying to clear yourself. You always worry about the karma. If you've done something to somebody, that something is happening to you. Moses said, a knife for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. And David is an initiate who understands the law of karma. As you sow that you reap. Now, in the evaluation of his karma, he is trying to understand, if he has done this before to someone, now you got to realize it. It could be before his present life or before he came to the realization of his illness. Oh Lord my God, if I have done this, the time cycle could be present or past. If there be iniquity in my hands, if there be a careless desire pattern set up, that means if I am totally responsible, if I have rewarded evil unto him that was at peace with me. Now you see how he goes about to show you the karma. If I have rewarded evil unto him that was at peace with me. If I hurt somebody in thought pattern who mentally, physically is at peace with me, yea, I have delivered him that without cause is my enemy. I have actually made that man my enemy. I am responsible. If I have actually hurt that person who was at peace with me, who had a mental love, a mental joy, and caused that person now to be in anguish, I have actually made that man or woman my enemy. That person now has a right to confront me by the law of karma. So he's saying now to the life force, let the enemy persecute my soul. Let me take my punishment. I have done it. I don't refuse to face my medicine. I don't refuse to drink this bitter cup. What I sow, I have to reap. But there's a lesson to learn in the involvement. Let the enemy persecute my soul and take it. Yea, let them tread down my life upon the earth. Means, let them go to the extent of ostracizing me, making me ridiculous before my fellow men, even tearing me up in all aspects, and lay mine honor in the dust. You see, if someone has hurt you, he has all right to do you anything to the point where he can't take your life. You see, the initiate has to be able to face the involvement of hurting someone and be hurt back. But he must also realize that life must persist over death. We don't have a right to kill, and we don't have a right to be killed back. Now, let the enemy persecute me, persecute my soul and take it, and lay my honor in the dust. That means I'm no longer respected by others. That is totally, but that doesn't say your enemy has a right to kill. Now, again, that wonderful Hebrew word, selah, comes in. That means so be it. It's got to happen. Gesundheit. The Lord's will, you sneeze, you got to see. That's, we're sneezing on the truth, you see. Right. When the truth is true, you've got to sneeze on it sometime. Case of last law, what it will be, will be. At you. It's a sneeze. That's what I call knowing the truth and understanding it. Now, the initiate is going on to describe David. He says, "Arise, O Lord, in thine anger." He has accepted his mistakes. He's accepted the fact that the individual he has hurt has a right to do his pain. Now he's calling upon the vital power which is in all of us, in the enemy that he's hurt, in himself, in thine anger. You see, he's saying he doesn't pull no bones there. He's not avoiding chastisement. He says, "Arise, O Lord, in thine anger, lift up thyself because of the rage of mine enemies, and awake for me to the judgment." In other words, this vital power must come into manifestation so that we both of us, myself and the enemy, can reconcile ourselves at some point. We have to come to a final confrontation. Now, in the final confrontation, one of the two must make some surrender to the Lord for his mistakes. He must admit his mistakes. So he's saying now, "Arise, O Lord, in thine anger. Lift up thyself because of the rage of mine enemies." In other words, this vital power that is triggering off the anger from the adrenals of my enemies are reaching a point where it can be destructive, it can be violent. "Awake for me," that means open my consciousness, "to the judgment, what has to be meted out to me, what I have to bear in this particular involvement, this particular tearing down, that thou hast commanded, the life force is demanding restitution between these two. I have hurt someone, and I don't understand how deep I hurt them. And I can't realize the anguish, the shock that will cause the person the hurt. Now, if that person returns that back to me, and I am in a state of turmoil now, this vital power has to come to a point where it will never get to a state of a feud. It must start stabilizing. So he says, "So shall the congregation, the people, compass thee about." In other words, all the human beings will begin to have compassion. They will begin to recognize, that human beings who have hurt one another must face one another and make some type of reconciliation with one another. "So shall the congregation of the people compass thee about. For their sake, therefore return thou on high." In other words, if two individuals hurt each other and the hurt continues to become a feud, other human beings are going to get caught up in the feud and they're going to take sides. Now, if you look at a war, one nation attacks another nation. The nation that is attacked may be weak. To prevent being swallowed up by the other nation, what does it do? It cries out for help. That encompasses other people to participate. And before you know it, what have we got? A world war, right? We have everyone being drawn into the situation because sides are starting to form. Equally true, David is realizing this and he is asking that this situation come to a head where it will not spread any further. So he says, "So shall the congregation of the people compass thee about for their sakes, for the sake of harmony and balance, return thou on high, bring about a halt, an end to this internal conflict. The Lord shall judge the people." That is, the vital life power shall be the guiding judgment in the individual. Then he goes on to make himself the specific target. "Judge me, O Lord, according to my righteousness."